Welcome to Talk of the Rock. I'm your host, Jared Griffin. According to 2022 data from the State Department of Health and Social Services, Kodiak has had the most cases of paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, in Alaska over the last 20 years. And over 50% of PSP cases were among Alaska natives. In late 2021, federal funding for a PSP monitoring program ran out, but it looks like some federal stopgap funds from the large omnibus spending package last year, plus some other federal funds, might be heading our way to enhance and extend the PSP monitoring program. And then on top of that, data shows that there is a 77% decline in reported PSP cases over the past 4 years. So to help us talk about PSP, PSP monitoring, the numbers and the data in PSP cases, are our guests for today, and they have a lot of titles, a lot of experience. So we're just gonna jump into it. First, we have Julie Matwiyu, associate professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the Kodiak agent with the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program at the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center, and who has been researching PSP off and on for about 25 years now. So welcome, Julie.
Yeah, thank you, Jared.
Also joining us are Mika Bushel, research fellow with NOAA and marine biologist for the Kinnick Tribal Council. Welcome, Mika.
Hi, thanks.
And someone else who's been working or researching PSP for several years is Andy Wall, the environmental coordinator with CANA. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. So before we get into some of these specific issues around PSP monitoring and how Kodiak's involved, let's get an eagle eye view of the research. And Julie, I'm sure this is a question you've been asked a bazillion times, but what is PSP, and why has it kind of captured your research interests over the years?
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, paralytic shellfish poisoning is not a new problem for our region. What brought me to Kodiak originally was to study PSP here in Alaska, in Kodiak. And Andy has recently been working along these same lines. Paralytic shellfish toxin is a naturally produced toxin. It's a saxitoxin released or created or put out by the phytoplankton, the Alexandrium. So it's a naturally occurring toxin that has been in our system for many years. And it's not new. Paralytic shellfish toxin is a neurotoxin that effectively blocks the sodium channel function of our nerve cells. So it prohibits the communication between our nerve cells, which can leads to paralysis. That's the name, paralytic shellfish toxins. Humans usually become sick eating shellfish that have accumulated the paralytic shellfish toxins. And that's the standard, basically this is the standard method of becoming or making humans sick. You can also become sick by eating the crab gut, the gut of the crabs, but the toxin does not extend into the meat. So we traditionally know it as the toxins are, put up through the benthic food chain and people becoming sick eating shellfish. There's a lot of different symptoms. Early symptoms are nausea, headache, vomiting. They can progress to more advanced symptoms like paralysis and eventually respiratory paralysis. So we have seen toxins accumulate at the level that have killed people here in Kodiak or making them very sick.
Well, that almost kind of answers my next question, which is how important is it to monitor PSP? And what are the things that we learn from PSP monitoring?
I'll kick it over to Andy. Do you want to jump in or we can continue?
Yeah, definitely. I can try and tackle this one first and then pop it over to Julie for anything I might have missed. But it's really important. I work for the Kodiak Area Native Association, and we run an intertribal consortium for environmental programs, and our priorities in our program come directly from the priorities of tribes. And so eating and consuming subsistence shellfish is culturally significant. It is economically significant because it's not a resource that you have to pay for. Oftentimes, if you're in a remote community, access to food is even more difficult than what we experience here, where we're currently all located. And so there's a huge significance for a variety of reasons. And so we're trying to make sure that people have access to information about paralytic shellfish toxins and harmful algal blooms on the island, because there is not a statewide program to monitor for this. You know, we think of the idea of Washington State, where you can have, where people are continuously testing for and observing, observing phytoplankton blooms or just levels, where then you can say this beach is safe to consume at, or you can go and get a harvest permit to go and consume. And there is, the state of Alaska says there's too much coastline, there's not enough, you know, monitoring that can happen consistently. And so there's been a really large effort from a lot of entities across the state to try and fill this funding because of the significance and importance that's seen, not only from, you know, the tribal level, but also from agency level and from a scientific background as well. So I think there's additional layers to that question that I think if you get Julie and I talking and Mika talking, we can talk about it all day. But I think that's the umbrella answer. But I'll kick it back over to the other side of the table to see if there's anything that I missed.
Yeah, I think the only thing I'd add to that, and thanks, Andy, you really summed it up well, is Alaska is a large state with a very expansive coastline, and that also makes monitoring quite difficult. And just the remoteness of a lot of communities and reaching them and making sure we're sharing the data so they can make informed decisions when it comes to harvesting is just really crucial to this issue in mitigating PSP and HABs here in Kodiak and among other areas of the state.
Yeah. And just to back up a little bit, the reason we wanted to come on right now is that this is the time that we see the phytoplankton becoming dominant in the food system, in the water. And we'd like to be communicating with the community. Our beaches are not tested for shellfish. Anyone harvesting shellfish, especially during summer months, are at great risk.
So do we see bigger numbers because it's getting warmer, or people, subsistence harvesting more at this time of year, or is it just a natural cycle? Why is this time of year?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So our waters are naturally full of nutrients. You know, we have high nutrient load here in our waters. We've got very healthy phytoplankton blooms happening in the spring. Basically, we just need sunlight. So when the waters become warm enough and enough sunlight to cause the phytoplankton to bloom, then we've got increased phytoplankton blooms. Again, primarily we have healthy phytoplankton. We do have this problem, this nuisance of Alexandrium, and the conditions become ripe for this Alexandrium to become prolific in the water and then become the primary dominant source of phytoplankton for shellfish to eat. So the shellfish accumulate the phytoplankton and the toxins and retain them and passed up through the food chain. But it's a summer thing. It happens in late spring, early summer, with the changing water temperatures and sunlight.
You wouldn't say that climate change has, warming of ocean waters?
No, it's definitely having an effect on our toxin profiles. We typically have seen this toxin develop in early May to late May, but with the changing climate, the predictability is not there. We're seeing toxins earlier on in the season and later into the fall. A lot of additional communication needs there with how the toxins remain in certain shellfish into the winter months, but we primarily see the potential for extreme toxins occurring in the summer. And yes, climate change has been changing the patterns of what we see in Alaska.
And I would even chime in and say that the efforts that are happening around the state to monitor on tribal or individual community bases are it's a climate adaptation strategy mm-hmm. that is being implemented to be able to harvest and test the shellfish and be able to get results back on your individual or community harvest. That is a climate adaptation strategy that is being implemented across the state because there has been an increase that we've seen. And so I think that the more that we can put the name to that of like that's what's mm-hmm. going on, the mm-hmm. the more connection. So yeah, it's a good really question.
So hit. So here's the. This is a super sciencey question, so maybe the marine biologist can help us out. But I've done some stories on PSP and have helped some projects through the college and listened to presentations. I've never really heard where does the toxin come from? Like how did it develop? Is there an evolutionary biological advantage for these animals to have this toxin?
Yeah.
What is the root of evil here?
I don't think that we fully understand the toxin. The phytoplankton produces this toxin as a metabolic byproduct. It's thought to perhaps assist with buoyancy. Maybe predation control, but it's really not known why or exactly how it's producing this toxin. There's a suite of toxins being produced inside the phytoplankton. So upon consumption of the phytoplankton, the toxins are passed through the food web.
Yeah, and I think one thing I would add to that is some bivalves or shellfish, they will sequester toxins at different rates and for different purposes. So, for example, some shellfish may hang on to toxins, and that could be a naturally evolved mechanism to prevent predation on themselves.
But again, it's not completely understood. Yeah. There's certain shellfish that will sequester and hold these toxins. That's why we still have a problem with paralytic shellfish toxins into the winter months, while other shellfish will release it. So there's a whole bunch of different ways to approach that topic and conversation. But in Kodiak, we primarily have a problem with the butter clam that is holding that toxin, sequestering it up into primarily the siphon and the siphon tip, and that's likely a predatory defense mechanism. But not all shellfish utilize that, so it makes it complicated when we talk to the public and talk about which species might be safer to eat than others. It gets complicated. Andy and I have been on the ground talking to our harvesters for many years now and trying to explain the differences. But we do know that in the summer, these toxins are being, created by the phytoplankton, so it's primarily very important in the summer months to avoid subsistence harvest without testing.
And if a predator comes along and eats one of these butter clams, though, then they can also hold the toxin, but we don't test further up the food chain, right?
Scientists have been looking the last few years more than before. And our partners have put out some really great information about food web transfer of toxins through the pelagic food web up into the fish and other species. We do know that the toxins can be transferred.
But for now, that's not really anything you're worried about? People getting sick because it's so rare?
The shellfish are the predominant carriers of the toxins because they accumulate the toxins. So they accumulate so much of the phytoplankton. They're directly feeding on the phytoplankton. So the shellfish become toxic very easily. Once it starts moving up the food chain, it gets diluted out or changed. It's not such a direct crab, however, are a problem because they're directly feeding on shellfish. Anything that's directly feeding on a bivalve can potentially carry the toxins, like a crab or a predatory snail. So we do see that direct transfer. It looks a little different. So for the case of crabs, it only accumulates in the gut. And so if you split the product, remove the gut tissue and not cook it whole,
and then
you've removed the toxin, the threat of the toxins. It's not transferred into the meat. So anything else to add there, Andy?
There's just so much. It seems like we need a whole class for cooking to remove toxins.
No, we can't cook it.
You can't cook it out.
Cook it out or freeze it out.
Well, and I would say, too, that there's areas that are the reason that we're centralized around shellfish in this area is because the importance to the people and the consumption rate that we're seeing here in this location on Kodiak. But again, this is a statewide issue, and other communities and organizations are dealing with the, you know, the more trophic level, the up the food chain, in addition to the shellfish issue. You know, I think of some communities consume the clams that are in walrus gut, for instance, and that's, you know, so the issue that we're talking about here in Kodiak is really specific, but also, like, I think we're starting to see well connected and branched out to other areas. But it is kind of for our topic, and our research and information sharing has been focused around shellfish because that's the primary area concern. For other regions, it'll be regional specific for based on their consumption habits and cultural needs or cultural values.
So is that why the cultural habits are one of the main reasons why the numbers are higher in Kodiak? Or do we just do a better job of testing in Kodiak?
So when that came out, I'll jump on this one, Julie, and then and maybe Julie and Mika can chime in. But again, those are reported numbers and information. So I want to make the distinction that we don't know what we don't know, and that's the information that is reported. And when that epidemiology report came out, you know, it was like, wow, okay, well, what is reading in between the lines? And you can guess about why that information has changed. But I have no real idea on why those numbers are different. But we do know that, you know, the level of consumption on Kodiak for shellfish is relatively high. It's hard to get an actual count on what that is, and what that looks like, because I think it's community specific, it's family specific. And so for me, when that report came out, I was like, whoa, you know, this is really interesting. But I can't read between the lines to know what I don't know. But Julie, anything to add to that?
Well, most of our historical information from the region has come about from testing after someone's become sick. And so those numbers that we see are often numbers that have created an illness or death. And then either the clam sample was submitted or scientists went back out to collect around that region. So when I share data that shares these really high numbers that have been recorded in Kodiak, they really have been around these illnesses and deaths that we've had in our community. So that's one component. And like Andy said, the underreporting, we don't know the true number of cases that have gone unreported. But yeah, a lot of our data has been around an illness or event. And it's often in a rural village due to subsistence harvest. And we did have some severe illnesses in 1994 and even a death in 1994 in the Kodiak area and in Old Harbor. And since then, there's been a lot of education and outreach, and I'd say a lot of people have stopped consuming shellfish for this reason. So, but there are still people that are harvesting, and often in remote communities.
Let's talk about Kodiak versus, you know, other coastal communities. Mika, you work with the Kinnick Tribal Council. How do you three work with other coastal communities off island? What kind of data sharing goes on there?
Yeah, thanks, Jared. Yeah, so I am a biologist with the Kinnick Tribe, and I am helping manage their PSP HABS monitoring mitigation project over the next 4 years. And so we actually have samplers, they're local samplers, and they are involved in this very extensive community-based monitoring program spread out all across the Gulf of Alaska, ranging from Aleutian Islands to here in Kodiak and to Southeast Alaska. And so we work together to send in samples, and we have them tested at the state laboratory, and then I work with other individuals and other agencies to disseminate the toxicity results, post them on websites, distribute them to other groups that can share them further, and then also share them to these coastal communities that are providing these samples. And so that's one way we can rapidly share this information, and also a great way to get samples from all around Alaska.
And you said HABS, that's hazardous algae blooms.
Ooh.
Am I close?
Kind of close. It's a harmful algal bloom.
Harmful algal bloom.
Yeah, there's so
blooms.
Many acronyms
okay.
in science.
Okay, harmful algal bloom.
Yes. Thanks for catching me on that one.
And I wanted to kick it back to Andy because we kind of went out of order. We started from a statewide perspective down. But Andy's program has been monitoring for these shellfish toxins here locally for a number of years. And with these partnerships, we've been able to expand and reach out statewide too, you know. So let me, I'm going to kick it over to you, Andy, and you can talk about your efforts here.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Julie. And I think the statewide perspective is really interesting too, because there are a lot of ways that it is connected. But I also, again, because there's not a statewide monitoring program, it is all grant funded. Mm-hmm. And so there are different grants that have different priorities and different deliverables. And so I think it is really important that Mika stated that that's a separate grant. While we can work collaboratively together, mm-hmm. we want to make sure that the programs are
complementary.
Thank you. Yes, complementary. So the program that Julie is referring to was a need for funding, again, grant-funded programs. Different tribes on the island were, in addition to Julie, were sampling for harmful algal blooms, and there was a gap in funding. And CANA had recently come on and started their environmental program and identified the gap in funding and applied for funding from the BIA, which is the Bureau of Indian Affairs Tribal Resilience Program. And we received that funding for 2 years, and were able to test for 3 years under that program to look at a baseline in multiple locations. And that program grew and evolved, and then funding stopped, and we had to look for another funding source. So we have a limited amount of funding right now, and we just hired Casey Jo Wright is going to be the new environmental technician, the boots on the ground, to be able to collect, to kind of restart that program, which is really, really exciting. We know it's been a need for the community and region. We know it's been a tribal priority, and we've been working really hard with project partners to find funding. And so we've got a $50,000 chunk of funding to be able to have 1 year of testing under this program. So we're starting slowly, and we're just getting Casey Jo on board to get trained. But we are really, really excited to, as the summer season is kicking off, we'll be able to have some long-term monitoring or some monitoring locations that are consistent every week in terms of testing for harmful algal blooms, to collecting water samples. And then every other week, CANA staff will be in the fields collecting shellfish. And then we will also be able to harvest or to offer our harvest and hold program, which is, again, a climate adaptation strategy that I think is going to be the most impactful and listeners might be interested in. We will be able to send in samples with CANA's shellfish shipments on an every other week basis. Mm-hmm. So if you don't harvest at the locations that are being tested weekly, you can go out to Middle Bay, or you can go out to, you know, your beach in one of the rural communities, send those in, and then we'll include them in our shipment to be tested for free. The idea is that people will be able to get paralytic shellfish toxin numbers from their individual harvest. You sacrifice 6 to 8 individuals from your collection, and we've got protocols and everything to walk you through, but this is the brief overview. You give us a couple of those of your selected shellfish. Well, we'll get those tested for you, and then we'll get results back to you on your individual harvest so you can make an educated consumption decision.
I had a guest on a couple of months ago about seabird mortality and monitoring, and she spoke about how important it is to train citizen scientists to do this kind of monitoring, to do this kind of work, because there's so much coastline, mm-hmm. and it's just, there's just no way, right, that you can cover all of it. And so it seems like a very similar model with the PSP and citizen scientists, which is really cool.
To some extent, yes. I mean, we rely on our residents and citizens to help us, especially if there's an emergency or very high levels of toxins. I'd say that a little bit different model is that these studies require funding to test
right.
versus the observation of a dead
right.
bird. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we still rely on people to grab samples for us, or if people see visual blooms of algae bloom, mm-hmm. they might submit a sample. We can try to identify that. But but yeah, it's a little bit harder because we need the funds and the coordination to get the shellfish tested. Yeah. I wanted to emphasize, I think our community has gotten very used to seeing the HAB hubs that Canada has put out. Mm. They've got locations, I think, currently at Trident Basin, Mission Beach. It's the poster board that puts this data out to the community, as well as the website delivery. And I think people are used to seeing that, and I'm excited to have that data coming back in. As a scientist, I look for it, too. I'm in close contact already with Andy, but I like to see that and take a look at those postings. So we've been working for years to have a unified message and a reliable way to, you know, provide information to our community. And Andy's going to be able to pick up testing again here in Kodiak, which is really great. And with the Kinnick Tribe partnership, Mika's here also to provide that information and also able to provide some harvest and hold. So, again, we've all been working really closely together and statewide and to develop these partnerships so that we do have information to share with our residents. So it's been pretty exciting to have these efforts underway.
Yeah.
So we have just a couple minutes left. What is the future of PSP monitoring? What does that look like?
We're getting started. We're going to collect our first water quality sample this week. We're going to see if we can get ourselves together to do the first beach harvest this week. But that is going to be dependent on how quickly we can get folks onboarded and comfortable with that process. Mm-hmm. But there will be continual communication coming through the CANA website, like Julie mentioned, on the HAB hubs that are around the community, and hopefully through community announcements and, again, this collaborative partnership and outreach that we're doing about the increased efforts that are gearing up around the island. So I would say this is our first big announcement, and we can stay tuned for more.
And Mika's project, Bruce Wright's project from Kinnick Tribe, is a 4-year study, so they can be expecting to find data from their communities for the next 4 years. Mm-hmm. And additionally, all of us, again, working together, we have a very strong chance of, we're poised to receive a 5-year grant-funded opportunity here in Kodiak, which includes CANA as a very strong partner, includes a position that Meek is holding right now as a fellowship between a fellow reporting to NOAA and UAF. Hmm. And so there's just lots of really strong opportunities ahead for us. And we're poised to be looking more specifically at Chiniak Bay, doing a scientific studies looking at the phytoplankton, the life cycle of the phytoplankton, water quality data in conjunction with this community sampling efforts that will help us eventually get to a harmful algal bloom forecasting model. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the ultimate goal, but we've got some years ahead of us here.
With some potential funding for being able to test here. Correct. On the island.
Yeah, that's another point. We've established capacity at the Kodiak Seafood Marine Science Center to conduct ELISA testing. It's a laboratory-based benchtop test. There'll be some work to groundproof that and keep those data close until we have a reliable source of, to share. But in the meantime, partnering with these other communities, including CANA, CTOR, and other phytoplankton monitoring efforts. But yeah, we've got efforts underway right now, too. So Miko this summer will be working in the lab and setting up that ELISA capacity for us and conducting shellfish screening here. It'll be screening results only until we're fully validated.
Well, great. Thanks. Thanks so much for the science nerdy episode of Talk of the Rock.
Yeah.
Thank you, Julie, Mika, and Andy for coming on and talking about PSP monitoring. And you can check out the CANA website. Might be the best place for people to go and look at all the new.
Or reach out to any of us for opportunities for harvest and hold and shellfish results.
Please contact us. Thanks for holding space, Jared.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Thanks for listening to Talk of the Rock.